Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts,
Hans Lemerson.
All right. Hello, everyone. Polycast episode 110, a nice big round number, and our second live episode from season 5. We're going to be getting started here now, and so I am Dan Q, and I'm joined by the Mian Team.
I've got good, bad, and ugly all in one package.
Hans Lemerson.
Hello.
And Makalua.
Must have caffeine.
Yes, there we go. I'm sure she'll be joining us shortly. Maybe we should, start with the email that we received earlier in the month from Exception, who wrote in. So this is our, it used to be called Mailbag. I'm experimenting with a different name here, seeing as how, I mean, it is Mailbag. We've given the live format. I'm going to...
Teabag?
There's Mackie. Hello.
Hi. Come over here and kill my headset. It's not being nice.
Oh, it's not, huh? Oh, so what did you unplug it and plug it back in?
Uh-huh.
Ah, yes.
Good times.
Basic computer trick. Unplug, unplug, then replug. And if that doesn't work, throw it on the ground and stomp it a couple times.
Oh, it wanted its 15 seconds of fame, but it forgot it was on Polycast and it just got 15 seconds. So, the email from Exception, Dear Polycast Team, I would like to hear about naval combat in Civilization V. I think it's pretty messed up as of right now because the ships are too easily sunk. Because of this and the fact that naval units can move that far in multiplayer, it amounts to the who-can-click-faster contest, which is really annoying. Even worse, the English are ridiculously overpowered on watery maps. How do you girls and guys think this problem could or should be fixed to make naval combat really interesting both in single-player and multiplayer? Greets, unquote. I do think naval combat is really interesting already, depending upon how you define interesting. You obviously think that this is a bad thing.
Is this like the Dwarf Fortress definition of fun?
Fun units. Yeah, think about the acronym there. No, this is, I find this particular mailing, mic-in, whatever it is, pretty interesting in itself, because one of the old complaints about Civ 5 navies initially was that they were not strong enough, so the naval battles would go on and on and on because neither ship could damage each other. And so you'd just get massive naval battles where it was more a question of patience than anything else. I think the biggest problem with navies in multiplayer is pretty much the same as the biggest problem with multiplayer in general. You still have the, turn-end nonsense with simultaneous turns. And fast units just exacerbate that. I really think that you should have a little bit more flexibility in terms of how you can move it and turn on multiplayer. And I would like to see some steps taken to avoid the double moving, because a navy double moving is really strong. And once you get into later eras, not too common in multiplayer probably, but once you get into later eras, the ships become a legitimate threat to cities too. And it can just drop a city's defenses in no time flat. And maybe even take it amphibiously, so you have to be really careful about that.
And I think England is overpowered by design. That's intentional, because they did have a really good navy at one point. So, England plus having a lighthouse plus naval tradition, maybe broken, but it's fun.
I don't think they're any worse than the Vikings or the Dutch in the previous Civilization game. So, I mean, yeah, they're going to be a little bit strong on water maps.
High naval movement has been an issue with Civ games since the start, because you're dealing with two conflicting issues. Navies have to be fast, otherwise there's no point in having a navy. If it takes years to cross an ocean and you're just crawling across, I mean, you don't even bother. But if they're too fast, then navies just pop out of the blue and they can engage each other in completely unexpected ways. So I first really noticed this in Civ 3, when, I mean, the navy's there, Actually, navies in Civ have always been just to escort transports. They don't. There have been some other features in later Civs, but the fundamental purpose is just
escort
farming. Okay.
Back in Civ 2, navies could actually attack units in cities. So that was pretty strong.
Yeah.
But also, navy units in Civilization 4 can bombard, so completely strip defenses away from any coastal city and open up amphibious attacks. And one of the most devastating things in Civ 4 multiplayer was to have a fork, which is where a navy could threaten, well, any group of units could threaten multiple cities at once. And it was very easy to fork two cities with naval units and then attack the weaker one amphibiously and just raise it. And pretty much all your coastal cities were vulnerable to that unless you had naval dominance. So it didn't become a question of escorting units any longer. They certainly did. But if you lost control of the sea, then they could just take their pick of your weakest defended city, hit it amphibiously, and, you know, you're forced to spread units is much worse than the penalty for attacking amphibiously. And then you get your most, like, a lot of your important cities burned, all your naval production burned. You're never leaving that island, and your tech rate is going to suck. That was usually a kill shot in multiplayer in Civ 4. And still in Civ 5, navies can easily make the decision on the outcome of the game.
Just to jump in here with some data back to the messaging about how powerful England is, +2 movement for all naval units in England. Mackie mentioned the Great Lighthouse. All military naval units receive +1 movement, as well as +1 sight. The Great Wonder. There's also, if you look at the Songhai, I think that the ability for their embarked units to defend themselves, because now we don't have transports that if you want one of your land-based units to be traveling across the seas. Of course, depending upon where you are in the game, just how vast a water that you can actually travel to be able to embark. I really like that. I like that change in the sense that it's forcing me even more so to have proper defense to go with those forces, only because that there is no, again, with the exception of Askia, there is no defense for those units. You could have a horseman, long swordsman, doesn't matter. I suppose you could even do that with a giant death robot. And they have absolutely no defense on the sea. So, to me, I think if you're looking at how am I going to help myself on the sea, whether it's single player or multiplayer, we already kind of came up in the email and Phil mentioned about the double moves. When you're looking at kind of your ancient units, your initial ancient naval unit that can help you with some combat. You've got your trireme, 6 strength, and 4 movement, and then that kind of helps you into the ancient, classical, medieval, and then when you get to Renaissance, you've got the frigate and the caravel options as well. So I think you need to be looking at, okay, what type of map do I have? I either do know in advance or I don't know in advance, and am I just wanting to explore, or am I actually looking at a particular invasion? I just, you know, Phil mentioned that in earlier Civ titles, it was just kind of a back and forth. There didn't seem to be any clear winner at times, and I really overall do like the change. I'm not saying that there's room for improvement, but I like the changes in naval combat, because it's forced me to have to rethink what I used to think. I think we'll just bring in some comments from the chat here. Imagine noted that it's arguing that the broken bit is ranged combat calculations using ranged attack values rather than the combat strength. So used the example of a missile cruiser a little later on. You know, it gets ruined just as fast as a destroyer, which is why navies suck right now versus artillery. Certainly, I'm not going to disagree with that. And when I think about naval combat, I'm thinking, you know, Renaissance and earlier, I guess, just because of how far my games usually go. So I will definitely defer to some other people as far as later game tactics.
I would like to maybe see the sea or naval battles reworked a little bit. Maybe that same ranged attack mechanic that you're seeing from, say, archery units or siege. They certainly already do something different with air power. And maybe at least for sea to land and land to sea firing, they can change that up a little bit. I know there's precedence for that in Civ. Any time in previous Civs where sea units were able to attack land units, they was treated a little bit differently than land to land or sea to sea. And that goes all the way back to Civ 2, and I don't know, maybe Civ 1, but at least to Civ 2. So there's some precedent for that, and I think it would really help the gameplay from the standpoint when it comes to the ranged attack versus land units or versus other sea units, and having a stronger versus weaker one, 60 strength versus 40 strength, as Majin points out.
So the comment here from Exception to me that it's pretty messed up right now because the ships are too easily sunk. I'm not going to agree with that outright. Again, it gets back to recognizing the change in how Civ 5 approaches naval combat and being able to adjust accordingly. And, you know, he also like makes the distinguishing between single player and multiplayer. And I think we've mentioned before already on the show that we get into, well, the AI is not very good at X. And that seems to be often as compared to playing with the human player. So I guess you can treat them in some respects differently. But I actually don't approach naval combat any different than, I shouldn't say any different than any other combat, oh my. But when it comes to naval combat, with the exception of the double moves thing that you can get into in multiplayer, oh geez. When it comes to naval combat, generally speaking, I'm not really going to be approaching them any differently between single or multiplayer. Thank you, Exception, for the email. We always welcome questions in advance. Our email address, thepolycast@gmail.com. So now we're going to be moving on to our next topic. Not to put Hans on the spot again, but which topic would you like us to go to next?
The chick parabola. The chick parabola is a phenomenon talked about by the reviewer Tom Chick about your enjoyment of the game over time, dealing with, well, it's actually an inverted parabola. As you begin playing it, it's not very fun because you're trying to, it's a lot of work to figure out what to do. Then once you start learning the game, it's going pretty nice and you're having fun. And then at some point you'll realize that the AI is an idiot and your enjoyment can start decreasing a little bit. The structure of the curve will vary by game, but it's...
The chick parabola comes from freelance journalist Tom Chick, who on a Three Moves Ahead podcast from March in 2009, further to what Hans was saying there. But then when he starts to discover that the AI is terrible, that it's a dumb game, and I start coming down the far end of the parabola, and I'm no longer fond of game X. So commonly there's this curve where I enjoy the game, and then I master system, and then less. It's got a good AI, I lose all interest because I realize that mastering the system is where the challenge ends. Once I reach that point, the game is dead for me, and I hate that. That's when the game should really start to take off. And I don't know so much that he's introducing the phenomenon as he's calling attention to the phenomenon, and it ends up being named after himself because he's the one that first put it out there, such as I know and such as a lot of people in the gaming industry know, in these particular words. And I think that can apply to any game, whether we're talking about Civilization, he talks about Empire Total War, whether we're talking about a strategy game or another type of game in the genre, or we could be talking about a video game or a computer game. Obviously not so much of a board game, because there really isn't good artificial intelligence in board games yet. I don't know what's up with that. To me... it's important to note that the chick parabola is there as outlined, and I think that when you have developers such as Firaxis and 2K and others who, I know we talked about this a little bit in the last episode, criticisms leveled against Civ 5, did the game come out too quickly, has the company been responding too slowly to issues, the fact that there is that engagement and to recognize the issues when it really comes down to the AI, because the AI keeps coming up with the chick parabola, that, you know, at some point you've got the AI figured out one way or another, probably figuring it out by, which probably means that you're winning more often than not, assuming, you know, that's what you like to do, then you're losing the interest. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but at the same time, you know, it does kind of dictate the extent that you're going to be playing the game and the interest that you're going to be playing the game. And so that's where I think when you get into major patches, as well as the ability to mod the game, that you help to extend the shelf life of a particular title. And I think Civilization 4 and even before that, Civilization 2 are good examples.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things in the article was talking about symmetry, like symmetrical game. It's where the AI has to play the same game as the human. And the difficulty you run into there is the AI has to actually compete on the same level that a human does. And from what I understand, AI programming can be fairly difficult. I haven't done a lot of research into it, but I've thought a lot about, like, how do you make a good AI? And how do you translate, sort of good gameplay, good concepts that a human knows for, like, bigger things are better. I want more. I will attack this way. How do you translate that into, like, actual things that AI does?
From what I've seen, one of the more cost-effective ways to make an AI stronger is to have it mimic human strategies efficiently, but not do so predictably. Like, you would have an AI, say, maybe chariot rush you at random, just depending. Like, if a rush is a viable tactic to it, it might consider that, or it might not. It might do something else. But then when it does choose to do that, it essentially follows the same cookie-cutter build order priorities that a human would in terms of, like, maximizing its hammers into chariots or whatever. That's just as an example. But you can never really make an AI as good as the humans in terms of just its thought planning and whatever. I think people's bigger problem with it, though, is some of its nonsensical stuff rather than the fact that it doesn't play perfectly. I mean, bonuses have been part of the game for the entire Civilization experience. Ideally, you get an AI that plays increasingly better as you get into further games in the series so that you don't have to rely so much on bonuses, such as Civ 4 Vanilla Deity, for example. But even so, if it plays a little bit better, you can cut those bonuses. But the big problem with the AI is when it starts going into nonsense. Like, you have the chain denouncing in Civ 5, or you have AIs that know that you traded with their worst enemy before you ever even met them in Civ 4. And things like that that really destroyed the experience. And when it becomes too obvious that they're playing a completely different game from the human with completely different rules entirely, not just some bonuses, but literally functioning under different rules, that's when it really gets frustrating and takes away from the game experience, in my opinion.
Perhaps then to segue into another topic, seeing as how Phil just mentioned it, looking at Civ 5 here specifically, the denouncing, the like or don't like, this thread started by Spartage. Do you like the denouncement system? Yes, no, don't care, or abstain? Jeez, abstain. Anyway, right now, by a slim majority of 58%, the answer is no. Spartage starts the thread. Now that we've had some time with the denouncing concept, I thought it would be fine to open a thread to see what you guys think about the idea. I personally don't like it because it seems like it's now a race to denounce everyone who has ever been angry at you. Perhaps to my detriment, but I see that, you know, not only the denouncement system, but then also the converse about, oh, so-and-so are friends, and I get the messages whether I've met the Civs or not. But I'm just like, that's nice. And the AI comes and asks me, and I'm just like, you want to be friends? Most of the time I'll be like, no. You know, given the option to denounce someone publicly in the game, I'm just, no. I'll let my actions speak louder than words. And perhaps I'm just missing something, but what exactly is the game mechanic to actually denouncing it? Like, I know now we can see, you know, positive and negative modifiers by hovering over. I've not actually seen someone be like, you know, you denounced us. Have I just not been paying close enough attention?
Yeah, they'll get pretty pissy with you if you denounce them. And also, they mind denounce, like, whether their friends have denounced somebody as well, they mind that. But what happens is you get these little blocks of packs of friendship, but then, you know, like, one person denounces another person, and then it goes into a chain cascade, and you can easily have permanent hatred between virtually every civilization in the game in a hurry if, you know, if things go wrongly. This has its perks, but I would like to see it be less permanent or less sudden. I don't know.
It's also a good indicator if somebody's pissed off enough to come about to kill you. It happened to me the other day as Caesar denounced me. And then a few turns later, oh, hi, here's his army.
Oh, okay. Well, I've had the experience of, you know, I should say a couple of times I've said, sure, let's be friends because I want to focus on somebody else. And then I find, oh, wow, just let you know we're no longer friends. And it's like, oh. Doesn't necessarily mean we're enemies, but that puts me more on alert than denunciation for some reason. I guess I just haven't been denounced enough yet because I'm just that likable.
I guess it's kind of like, if you get denounced and they're really close to you, you should start watching for an army and start building your own.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, this isn't directly related to denouncement, but something I've been thinking about is how would the system used in Europa Universalis for having to have casus bellies in order to declare war, how well would that translate to a game of Civilization? If you insult somebody, then you think that might give them a reason to declare war on you, and so you might be a little hesitant to denounce people who are more powerful than you, so there'd be a dynamic like that. But yeah, I've been thinking, like, yeah, in Civ, there's really, you just declare war on someone when you feel like it, and don't when you don't, or you get war declared on you, but there's no sense of, like, whether you had a reason to declare war or not. And there's no sense of whether a war is justified.
That's going to be kind of difficult because we're used to it Civ of our casus belli being, I need your land now.
Yes.
That would be a very big change for people to get used to. We also have the problem of what would qualify as things for the casus belli. I mean, does getting your pact of friendship broken, is that one? Is lurking towards someone's borders too much? That is putting a settler towards them when they give you that message? Is that a casus belli?
You'd also worry that the AI could get a lot more of those and get away with it than the human. Like, I could just picture that happening now. Or the human could manipulate the AI into performing actions that would make it valid.
Yes.
Not that you can't do that in you, but...
Well, I'm just saying, it's going to poke even more holes in an AI that's already got plenty.
It won't be just the regular kind of Swiss cheese, it will be the lazy kind of Swiss cheese.
Cheese.
Ah, yes, welcome to Awkward Silence. I'm just looking over our topics list here and trying to think of a good segue into another topic, but I'll defer my having to make that decision and ask, Phil, what topic shall we go on to next?
Oh, fine. Let's take a look at worker steals. The thread you linked here is by Tresso, I think so, and he asks, is it always worth it in the beginning of the game, mainly if you are planning to wipe a civ from the world? And worker stealing has been around in Civilization as long as I've played it, at least. Maybe not in Civ 1, because I think the worker and settler are the same unit, but after that, it's always been something you can do, and it's always something you see routinely in Hall of Fame games. And we got some discussion going down this list on this particular thread, talking about when you should and shouldn't do it. Apparently you can always get away with one declaration on a city-state to snipe a worker, and a lot of times you can even do it to the AI and pick up workers. Anytime you can safely do it, and you know, it won't like ruin your game plan otherwise, it's a pretty big advantage, because you get a very nice boost right at the start of the game. So virtually any situation like that, definitely do it. Otherwise, I mean, I don't know, you might have to worry about diplomacy a little bit, but I'm not sure what the long-term ramifications are of that if nobody's met you other than, you know, your worker steal target.
I think it's mentioned in this thread how some people kind of allude to, when it comes to your first worker, you know, wait till you can go grab a city-state worker. I think either... No. As it's pointed out, it takes too long. You can either rush by it or you can construct it yourself. So do that, and then, I mean, when it comes to Ooh, look, there happens to be a worker that's been captured by a barbarian. Was it a city-state worker? Was it another civ, quote-unquote proper civ's worker? You may or may not find out if and when you actually capture that worker. If the worker is undefended and roaming around, you know, as Phil said, if you've only met, you know, one or two other civs, early enough on in the game, I think the impact is going to be minimal, even if they're really, really, really pissed off. Unless they happen to be that much stronger than you and have their military in a position such that they can take advantage of that, I think you're going to be all right. I mean, if that's the only kind of attack that you do, you're probably going to be looking at a Cold War situation. And as someone else pointed in the thread, it's not only about gaining workers, particularly when it comes to like a quote-unquote proper AI or a city-state to a lesser extent. You're denying them that worker so that they have to go out of their way to construct another worker when they could have been, in fact, constructing else while you're getting that much farther ahead. Once, of course, you move the worker into wherever it is that you want. I got no problem with stealing workers most of the time.
The only thing I worry about with doing it is starting a chained announcement again. Is if you piss off one AI, it's going to stay pissed off, possibly. And if it does that long enough to just denounce you, then it could turn badly. So I guess it's also a question of who else you've met, really, and who else you think you'll meet in the near future. One thing I don't see it being discussed a lot here, that amazes me, is whether or not this is exploitative or unfair. Almost always when you see these worker steal threads crop up, there's somebody presenting that argument. And I think I went through the entire first page, and nobody complained about it being cheap. And I love that. That is a very good thing. I congratulate Civ 5 Strategy and Tips for not doing that, or not making a big deal of it. Because I always get tired of seeing, like, X strategy is an exploit, you can't do it. It's part of the game. It was left in the game for a reason. You know, Firaxis is ignorant. If they wanted to block you from worker stealing, they absolutely could. And it actually could. There'd be no trouble at all doing that.
Hey, talk to the barbarians about it being an exploit. They do worker steal all the time.
Yeah, they'll spawn a unit and telefrag you with their three movement spawn attacks.
Yeah, it's like, what? My worker's been captured. What are you talking about? There wasn't a barbarian there last turn. Oh, jeez.
There is now.
That's where barbs are handy. They do the worker steal for you. You kind of subcontract it out that way.
Too bad you couldn't contact the barbarians and say, hey, you know
hey,
what?
Yeah, see Egypt over there? Could you steal their workers for me? Thanks.
That'd be great.
Nice bonus for you.
Now, yeah.
That'd be interesting if you could pay gold to the barbarians to make an attack in a different civ.
That'd be fun, and then somehow the AI would know about it. You brought barbarians on us.
Barbarians. I don't know any barbarians. Except you.
Like literally just drop the camp near them. Just keep spamming camps.
The only thing, I wouldn't say you wouldn't have to watch, and it's just kind of a quirky sort of thing, but I do find it amusing how if, use the barbarian worker as the best example, like if it's protected by someone and you decide, oh, you're actually going to bombard that, so you've got an archer nearby or something. I love how the ability that you can actually injure the worker by bombarding it, and I've made that mistake a couple of times. It's like, oh, I could have just moved in and captured it. What the heck am I doing? Like, pay attention, Dan.
So do you have anything else on worker stealing? I mean, as long as you can pull it off, it seems like it's generally solid. So
yes. Just not relying on it is all. And I know some people get into, oh, but later on in the game, you know, I just end up deleting workers because there's nothing left for them to do. Well, they are good cannon fodder. They're good cannon fodder. Here, why don't you come out of that city there, or come out of that tile that's got good defensive value, and go after my undefended worker? Yes, please do. Okay, poof. There you go. That was a mistake. There, congratulations. You were able to capture my worker for one turn and do absolutely nothing with it, and I was able to take that unit out. That would have been a lot more time and effort. I appreciate that.
That strategy's been around for a while, too, actually.
You can try it on humans. You probably have some variable results there. They'll probably learn, too. That's the other thing.
Yeah, it might work a few times, but then that person, if you play with them, go, oh, they're doing it again.
That's not going to work on anybody good.
So that just means you can't play with the same people very often. You know, you play, okay, I've had one or two games with you, now you've got that, now I've got to find somebody else who doesn't know my tricks. All right.
So are we staying in the Senate here?
Yeah, I suppose we can. Let's see, we've got a few left here. Mackie, which one would you like?
Well, the last thing I see in the Senate is the Wonders thing, so I guess that.
All right, yes, Wonders. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Terrible title for a movie, but other than that, I'm following you. Who would like to start? I have something a little planned for this thread, but, you know, I'm not going to say any more right now.
I can start this off just because I would like to point out, well, the thread's by Delra, and pretty much it's a list of wonders that he or she considers good, then, like, kind of bad or mediocre, and then just terrible wonders. Some of these have changed in their value, though, since the original post, which was on September 27th of 2010. Game has gone through a number of patches since then, and so you know, the relative value of some of these wonders have changed. For example, any wonder that gives Great Scientist points now is a lot more than it used to be, where Great Scientist points were a dime a dozen running two scientists off of your library. And there's some I just straight up disagree with, but it would be a little long to read through the list, so I think I will defer to whatever Dan has planned for the thread.
So that way, if the reading gets too long, then it's my fault. That's a very good strategy and works 9.6 times out of 10. Steady show. So this initial post, and then the subsequent posts trying to disagree with some of those things on there, and I think my favorite quote from this thread, which I've said before on the show describes anything, comes from Evan B. Good, which is, many of those wonders also seem to be situational, and that is forever difficult when you're talking about the best of this or the worst of that, and also issues with the AI, etc. And some of these wonders are better depending upon not only your particular circumstances, but what type of victory you are going for. So what I tried to do is to try to come up with a list of wonders, not necessarily in any particular order, except I tried to keep them more or less in order that they appeared and or their hammer cost, etc. In terms of, if you're looking for general wonders, what to try to go for, what is worth an investment, generally speaking, which ones to go for. And unless I counted incorrectly, we have 28 wonders in Civilization V, and I did come up with a top 10 of sorts, and then I thought, well, let's round out to honorable mentions, and let's actually mention half of them. So why don't we actually just start more or less in order? Let's see. The first wonder I'm going to mention begins with the letter S and ends with the letter E. What wonder am I referring to?
Stonehenge, a.k.a. how you get culture in the early game fast?
Plus a culture, 120 hammers available at calendar worth every single hammer. Hello, social policies that you don't have to work as hard for later on and get that much farther down whatever particular social policy you want. Still also in the same vein, a free social policy from the Oracle. 150 hammers available at philosophy, also worth the time. Now the Great Library, the free technology, 150 hammers available at writing is also nice, although I do think if it's, do I go with the Oracle, go with the Great Library? Yeah, you should be paying attention to what particular resources you have if that's going to increase your production capability. But beyond that, I would argue the Oracle over the Great Library just because of how incredibly powerful social policies can be, as long as you're choosing the right ones, which it's not always guaranteed. But anyway, and a lot of the other ones have to do with gold and a certain type of age that is particularly shiny.
Oh wait, who wants to guess this one? Could it be a golden age?
Oh, it's a golden age. Did I get points?
This one, I'm thinking actually
Himeji Castle, definitely Himeji Castle. It's not the Taj Mahal, no. Definitely Himeji Castle.
Well, it's true, Taj Mahal is on my list for an immediate golden age, but before you even get into a golden age or subsequent golden ages, get Chicken Itza so you can increase the length by 50%. Oh my.
Chicken Itza!
Wow, yes, I'm more like, I know some people actually said, let's start comparing what Civ 4 Wonder Effects gave you as compared to Civilization 5. And I'm really liking what Chicken Itza gets you in Civ 5. And Civ 4 didn't have something to do with defense or something?
25% defense in all cities. That took a long time to obsolete, though. So it could get pretty annoying, but
yeah,
there's more an AI in Wonder to annoy you.
AI, yeah, we saw the AI build it. It's like, no.
put some cannons can't take care of. No worries.
I think it was pointed out in the second thread. It actually got to the second thread, and I echo this person's sentiment, even though I can't remember your username. Maybe I'll try to look it up here in a moment. But he goes like, how come nobody's mentioned Forbidden Palace yet? Which actually did surprise me. It wasn't mentioned in the opening post or anything else on the first page. Unhappiness from number of cities reduced by 50%. Yeah, it's 600 hammers, and it comes at banking, but still, again,
it,
for general...
It is nice.
Just to the listeners for reference, it has since been nerfed and is not that strong any longer, I believe.
Oh, is it something that unhappiness reduced in some other condition
I
for
I think
city?
Along with the meritocracy civic, it got nerfed because it was a little bit too good.
Is it something to do with being occupied or not being occupied now or something?
Yeah, Majin can just confirm it is down to 25% right now. The Forbidden Palaces, and that's the same as what happened with the meritocracy social policy in the Liberty Line. That was done to weaken Infinite City Sprawl in theory, although Infinite City Sprawl is still around plenty, but that was the, you know, it did weaken it a little bit, so there you go.
Okay, so Aether on the list, again, this is just kind of general purposes, generally speaking, whatever particular victory condition you're going for. It's hard to discuss these things in a vacuum, but trying to stick to it anyway. Taj Mahal, available at printing press. There's an immediate golden age, 600 hammers. So even if you didn't get Chichen Itza from before, still the value of golden ages, and then certain civilizations get extra value in golden ages. The one that's popping to my head right now is Darius, the increased movement and combat strength, I guess because I played Darius recently. Also, any wonder that gets you a great person that just poof appears that you can translate into something else, like the Porcelain Tower at Education for a great scientist. A little later on in the game, two free great artists from the Louvre. There's also, towards great people, the Hagia Sophia, plus 33% generation of great people in all cities. Like, for example, some people mentioned the Colossus in this thread, but as someone pointed out, that's only for the city that it is built in. It's not for all of your cities, which is a darn shame. Otherwise, you know, on a lot of maps where you have a lot of coastal cities, I'd be putting it on the list here. I'd also put Machu Picchu up there, plus 20% gold from trade routes, just that the city must be built within two tiles of a mountain. And yes, it does depend on how well your economy is doing, whether or not that plus 20% is really that well vested for the 550 hammers that that's going to be costing you to get, but I'd still put it on the list as kind of a general purpose one. Honorable mentions. So to me, these are beneficial, but they're not as strong as kind of the top 10. There's the Hanging Gardens for plus one population in all cities, but considering how early it can come, you may not have that many cities, so, I mean, it could still be of a benefit, but I'm more likely to capture it, and then I'm getting the plus three happiness and the plus one culture from it. And it's like, oh, the AI built that for me, that's nice. The other three I've got on here are later game wonders, so in addition, not so much because of their cost necessarily, but just because they're later on in the game, and I think it's fair to say, maybe I'm generalizing, that most people play from the ancient era going forward, so if you're talking about later starts, then obviously some of these things have already been built or not as strong, etc., etc. There's Big Ben for a great general to appear, so there's another great person that you can use for some purpose. You know, if you're going the conquest route, okay, then maybe you want to actually use them in combat, or...
Wasn't that Brandenburg Gate? I'm pretty sure Big Ben is related to rush buying.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes, Brandenburg
Gate. Definitely Big Ben at 25% purchase cost reduction, not a great general.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected on the name there. Then there's the Sydney Opera House, which is a free social policy. Now, it's pretty late in the tree. It's 1,000 hammers, but still... a free social policy at any time in the game is welcome. And then Statue of Liberty, plus one production from specialists in every city, in addition to plus one culture, available replaceable parts, 1,200 hammers, if you get that far in the game. So is anyone here going to... other than Imagine, of course, this is their better lists out there. Well, there are always better lists out there. You know, there's like one better list out there, Imagine. You're probably right. I'll take second best. I don't know, is there any other wonders that I didn't mention that people want to argue for as kind of a good general purpose one, because that's kind of seemed to be the focus on this thread. I mean, they were trying to get, like, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I really hesitate to categorize any wonder as ugly, getting back to, again, the point about many of these wonders seem to be situational. Just some better than others.
Yeah, I don't know. I never liked these kinds of ranking lists because of the situational nature they have. When you're looking at, like, a given unit type or a given wonder, just because you're going to have situations that are going to favor one or the other. So I really don't see much more to add beyond what you've said, other than look for situations where a given wonder is going to benefit you more than it normally would. And if you see them, then consider building it. That's really how it goes.
Or you should build all wonders all the time and never build any military and be next me.
One city challenge strategy. Build everything in that one city. It works. You can win that way in most difficulties.
So we do have one person in the audience who would like to join in on the call here. He's been a past guest co-host, so I'm assuming there's something that we have said or not said with regards to this topic or not that he would like to see us discuss, and that is Mr. Cole. So, hello, Mr. Cole.
Hello, and I need to get off this page now.
Yes, we're all better in stereo, but only to ourselves, I think.
Only to yourselves? Yeah, well.
Well, Dan never gets tired of listening to the sound of his own voice.
So I have to say, I have been impressed, you know, as one who was on here before you were live. There's been no Mackie rap. There's been, you know, no times where you've had to beat people. I'm very impressed. You have cleaned things up. This is amazing. So
We don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, I see. Of course not. Of course not. No,
always racist behavior.
We have to have plausible deniability.
On the wonders, I think you're discounting some of the later era wonders like the Cristo Redentor and some of these things too much. Yes, they're only useful if you're going for a cultural victory, but if you're going for a cultural victory, they're very useful. I mean, the Cristo Redentor, well, I think that increases your culture rate in all cities. May do something else. I'm not. But I was on my first culture victory. I was only able to win because I was able to get that wonder.
Isn't that it reduces the culture cost for adopting new policies by about a third?
Yeah, that may be it too. I forget. There are several of those that are really great that you didn't seem to mention that reduce culture.
Yeah,
costs.
It drops culture policy costs. That's what Cristo Redentor does. But that is like only really useful if you're going for a cultural victory. And a lot of these late-game wonders, they come late enough where you've already decided the outcome of the game functionally by that point, one way or another, so it just makes it harder to rate them as highly as you might otherwise.
Not if you're playing on a large map, like a large Terra map with a lot of civilizations where things...
Even if you are, what you do early game is so important. That's been true in every Civ. You can usually get to a position where you know whether or not you're going to win on most difficulties, you know, within the first third of the game. Or at least, you know, have a highly probable estimation of your ability to win at that point.
I think the AI has still done some things to, and now maybe it's just because I'm not as good a player as some of the rest of you, but the AI has still done things toward the end of a game to make me have to reevaluate the way I'm playing. I mean, you can't pick up a cultural victory if you're going for military, for example, but usually I've had to settle for a space victory as opposed to a military victory or something like that. But, I don't know, I think some of those late-game wonders are actually pretty useful. But then what about in multiplayer? Does that change which wonders are good and which wonders are not? Are there wonders that are useless in single that are useful in multi? And is there ever a time in multiplayer where you should be building a wonder, or should you just be building military all the time?
So we're talking about competitive multiplayer here, right? Not cooperative?
Well, I'm assuming any time you're playing multiplayer, you want to win. Multiplayer where the other players are trying to beat you, yes. Not our strange multiplayer where we don't beat each other.
I think you have to still look at wonders for their value in a multiplayer setting, but you have a much higher threat near you in general when you're playing against other humans. So your relative prioritization of the wonders is going to drop, and that's also going to be true for your rivals. You know, the person who goes wonder gung-ho is probably going to be toast. But if you work them in now and then, while you can still defend yourself, you can still probably get some good wonders along the way. It's always interesting in multiplayer, though. You'll see, like, in, say, Civ 4, Stonehenge goes at, like, 1,000 BC or something, because nobody goes for it early, fearing a rush. But eventually, the Wanderers are going to go. They're going to be around, and somebody's going to feel like they can defend themselves and pick up a very useful Wanderer, and then they're going to take it. And, you know, sometimes they'll take a risk to get it early, or sometimes it'll still be run late, and you can get it without the risk. But that's just basic, you know, planning around what your opponents are going to do and a little bit of the guessing game that goes into playing multiplayer, which unfortunately is kind of ruined by the way multiplayer is right now. But hopefully that can get shored up and fixed. Then, you know, considerations like this will be relevant and fun in a multiplayer setting.
I think you could find that if, depending upon the nature of the map also in multiplayer as well, if you're on a continent by yourself, except for maybe some city-states, if you've got those enabled, then you're, and other people are feeling similarly, they've explored, and they may feel like, okay, I'm actually going to build some of these wonders earlier on because it's going to be beneficial for me to be able to spread out. So then maybe some of those earlier wonders that generally go later, even in competitive multiplayer, you know, that might go later normally would kind of surface a little earlier, but yeah, other than that situation, or I mean, really, in competitive multiplayer, if you were trying for, I'm assuming by competitive multiplayer, it's that people are trying to wipe each other off the map. It's not that, you know, it's always peace, for instance, if you've got some, you know, any kind of in-house rule that you're not going to do that. Although I suppose in that case, even in that competitive situation, perhaps wonders that may end up being beneficial to you are those that could actually help with your defense if you're feeling as though that you are going to be threatened either, you know, mid to late game. I can't think of their names off the top of my head, but I know there's one that increases your combat ability in friendly territory and another one later on that increases the strength of your defensive buildings like castles, for example.
Magic Castle and Kremlin, respectively.
Ah, there we go.
How effective is turtling, and yet still in multiplayer, for those of you who play it more often than I do? I mean, I tried once as Japan, and I survived until the game disappeared and was no longer viable because somebody dropped, but I don't think I would have been able to turtle enough to actually win by a non-combat route. But it was interesting to try. Has anybody else tried that, and is it at all effective?
I haven't tried it, but I can't picture that winning out over a military strategy. Now, you can turtle to them until you can find an opportunity or get an advantage, but I just can't picture, unless you're just dominating everybody but deliberately don't end the game, winning a victory condition in multiplayer other than through military. Yeah. I just can't picture that happening.
We really need.
I'd like for that to be possible, but yeah, that victory condition balance just isn't there.
I wish it was. But I have no idea how you could make that possible and make
it
still viable.
Yeah, I don't know. I was just done it, so I mean, it would be nice to see, but
yeah.
Imagine mentions here in the chat oligarchy and universal suffrage.
No, ah, yes, true.
I don't remember what those do.
It's for extra defense in your own territory. Oligarchy is a tradition, not a social policy, that will boost your defense in your territory like 33%. Well, no, your strength. It's a 33% modifier to your combat strength in your territory. And then what would the other one? Universal suffrage. Pretty sure that boosts the strength of your cities. So yeah, if you stack those up with if you have like something like oligarchy and honor together, that gets really crazy in your borders.
But then if you go out of your borders, you know.
Well, yeah, then you're
the maybe that would be good. That's a turtle strategy. I'm gonna think about that.
Yeah, universal suffrage under the freedom branch for city strength increased by a third. And earlier in the thread, just on wonders in general, Imagine argues that only Big Ben, Forbidden Palace, and Pyramids are must-have.
Well, I disagree with that.
Forbidden Palace, I can see that. Big Ben, Pyramids a must-have? You can make that argument. I don't think that one is a particular must-have.
See the Pyramids doing that if you get them early. Because the amount you'd have to invest into workers to get things done is much reduced. Only problem with serfdom in Civ 4 was how late it was available. So, and that you had to give up something really powerful like slavery or caste system to get it. Without those restrictions, it would have been very strong. And Pyramids kind of mimics that.
I suppose to me with the pyramids, and mentioning here that, you know, workers are too slow. They certainly are slower, and I can certainly see that also, how we can't stack workers like we could in Civ 4. Drat. And I guess it also comes to me that, particularly when you can get the pyramids, are you going to be able to get the workers to improve terrain that you can then actually start to work? And I guess that also gets into the city's ability to grow, and also you're taking advantage of in-game mechanics in order to get the workers to grow. And the fact that the pyramids do not expire does help, so that later on, if the city has grown and you've already got that infrastructure in place, then you could also be, you know, mixing and matching more in terms of, I've got more choices in terms of my citizen management. So I guess I could see that. I still don't think it's a must-have. I think it's nice to have, but okay, maybe.
Yeah, I would certainly put the Stonehenge before the pyramids.
Just to give some voice to some other things that came up in the thread, Martin Alvito argues that on Deity, the opportunity costs of early wonders are just too high. While you are building great stone and marble monuments to your importance, the AI is settler spamming all of the good city sites and building an early army to rush you. On any level, up to and including immortal, the benefits of the early wonders are too great to ignore, and this dichotomy is why there is such a difference of opinion in this thread. Now, I'm not able to speak to anything above Emperor, so I guess he's not talking to me. Although I certainly, even as compared to where I started out at Prince and then working up to Emperor, I do think less and less in terms of less and less of quantity over quality, where I'm having to be very specific about what wonders I'm going for and the timing, and heck, sometimes I'm just... Sometimes I'm just going for a wonder. I really don't want it necessarily. I'm just looking for the fail goal.
Is that common? I've never actually gone for a wonder to try and get the fail gold. I suppose if I saw somebody else was making it, but
they made building wealth so worthless that it's worth considering now. And it really always was. If you have, especially if you have a wonder resource to boost it, marble. Then if you want to convert hammers to gold, it's much better than building wealth.
Interesting.
Yeah, because wealth is like, what, is it plus 10%?
Yeah, I think it moved it up to 25%, but it's still absolutely terrible.
Well, even your cities that are apt to be nice, where you might actually consider, okay, maybe that's actually worth it, you're thinking, no, I'd rather actually be building something else. The city can be useful in other ways.
Yeah, the conversion is just so awful. It's really hard to build wealth in this game. It was just complete contrast from the previous one.
Well, there's so many other ways to get wealth. I mean... The AI still seems to have, in the late game, a huge problem of having money, but I have gotten over to where I don't have that problem anymore.
It is, and it's your game-bound duty to deprive them of that responsibility, of managing that great amount of money.
Absolutely. One way or another, too.
Mm-hmm.
There's more than one way to deprive them of that responsibility, after all.
This is true, but some are more fun than others.
So that's also true.
There's also Rittmeyer in this thread, and... here's kind of an absolute statement. I'll take the opportunity to just say that, in my opinion, all wonders are bad. At least in higher levels, there's very little incentive to build any wonders at all. I, at least, never build any of them.
Wow.
Oh, man.
What is wrong with this statement?
Wow.
Everything.
Well, you can always let the AI build them for you while you're building your army.
Yeah,
but that's sometimes they don't build the right wonders, so it's just kind of incidental.
Yeah, I'm building the 8 longswords wonder.
People who play the game only for war.
No, I play for
it. It was designed to favor that. It's like complaining about it and like people taking advantage of overpowered features in any game. I mean, of course you're going to pick that. It's the strongest feature.
Anything else here, Daniel, on wonders or anything else that we've discussed so far?
No, don't think so. Thank you for letting me chime in on that.
And this keyboard of death has been brought to you by Lisa.
Hey, sorry, I came back from the deck, only I was just asleep really deeply.
My mind.
She woke up at one point and went, oh, it's Saturday, I can sleep in. Wait a minute, was I supposed to do something?
Oh, no.
Lisa was dreaming about how good Polycast could be, and then woke up to the horrible reality that it is what it is.
Yeah, I can't hear the first thing that I said this morning because it's a friendly, family-friendly live podcast, but it was...
I think I'm familiar with that phrase. Yep.
Can we guess what letter it begins with?
You know, I heard that as long as the first and the last letter are correct in a word, if the other letters are scrambled in the middle of the word, as long as you have the context, your brain can probably fill in actually what is being said. I mean, I mentioned S begins with S and ends with E a little earlier in the podcast with regards to a wonder, and Mackie had it in a matter of seconds. No editing required.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Why don't we go ahead and actually do the conclusion to the show. I'll start by asking our guest co-host, Hans Lemerson here. Do we regret coming back?
Not really. I mean, there's only some slight awkwardness, given that I've never actually played Civ 5 and I'm talking about it, so...
Don't worry, I did that for months.
It's true.
A little different format now that we are live as opposed to the pre-recording. A little less technical work for you to do in terms of software required. So I know that does change the nature of it, and it has been observed in the chat. We've been very, very well behaved.
Relatively speaking.
True. Relative to what we used to be.
But again, I don't know what you're talking about.
And my mother is a saint.
Yeah.
You didn't ask us if we regretted coming on here.
All the time. I don't care if you regretted coming on here. You're here. You're staying. That's the rule. I'm going to put you guys in a caste system because, you know, that way your role won't change very much over time. It'll be easier to remember.
That we already were in a caste system.
Exactly. And then you see you'll be better at the workshops, too. Ooh. Which I have good use for that. So, yeah. You guys can take care of that for me, I'm sure.
I can convert grasslands into plains forests.
We're definitely going a little... what's the word I'm looking for? Unscripted, unlike the rest of the show, which was completely scripted.
Right.
Oh yeah. We were sticking to the script. All of the awkward pauses were in there, right?
We had like a straight line, and we had in those little like hyphens, awkward pause. So we didn't want to do it, but we had to because that's what it told us right there. It said clearly in the language to have an awkward pause. Yeah. So I mean, that's our obligation.
We had several table reads over the past couple of weeks so that this conversation would sound natural. So I hope everyone appreciates our efforts.
Yeah. It smelled foul odor of mendacity.
Smell some
word.
So, in addition to our guest Hans Lemerson, also joined by the fashionably late but ever wonderful Lisa Q&L.
Bye.
The everly wonderful period, Mackie.
Hi, bye. Caffeine's kittens.
And the ever opinionated and on the ball, the main team.
I love bringing you guys such wonders as Skill Dorado and perhaps even the Pro Pipe in Call of Duty.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to episode 110 of Polycast. Perhaps just a final shout-out here to the people who I can still see in the channel here at the end. Civ Colonel Mustard, Llama Lab, and Zeldar, along with our three guests and my three fellow regular co-hosts in the chat room as moderators, and of course myself as the broadcaster. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and keep on civin'.
I waved, and then I realized I was kind of dumb.
Some random person walking down the street. A woman acknowledged me. Oh.
I got acknowledged by a woman once.
Me too.
Your mom?
I jumped out of her. You see, that was acknowledgement. She acknowledged my presence because I scared her. Wait, that's not what we're going for.
Record date January 22nd, 2011. Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.